Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
On President Obama's last day in office, he granted local author Stephen Harrington a presidential pardon. Steve Harrington's book, In DeLorean's Shadow, The Drug Trial of the Century by the Sole Surviving Defendant, has received national recognition. It has been recognized as a finalist by the Beverly Hills Book Awards. Later in the hour, I will ask Steve about his true crime memoir. My first guest was born near London and grew up in Southwest England. Robert Burton's undergraduate degree in English is from the University of Kent at Canterbury. Then he continued his English and American studies in the United States at Indiana University. For the past 30 years, he has been a professor of English at California State University, Chico. One of his previous books was Hops and Dreams, the story of Sierra Nevada Brewing Company. He now has a book of short stories, London Spirits, which uses narrators, some dead, some alive, some historical, some fictional, who tell about their life and times in London. Rob Burton, welcome.
Thanks, Nancy. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Well, you grew up in England and you studied first there. And I'm wondering, how did you choose Indiana University?
Well, actually, I got a scholarship from Kent University in Canterbury, which brought me to Indiana in 1977, just for 1 year. But you know how things tend to move on. So at the end of my first year, I was able to get a fellowship as a TA at Indiana and then proceeded to spend the next 7 years working on a dissertation. So that got me the PhD, and then that led to my first job in the College of Charleston, where you and I, of course, have a common base.
Yeah.
And then after 4 years there, I relocated to Chico.
In fact, my master's degree is from Indiana University, and I chose there because they have a strong linguistics program. I left there a couple of years before you arrived, and then I got to College of Charleston just after you arrived, and here we are in Chico, and it's...
That needs to be a story one day that one of us should write.
Well, there you go. There's your next book.
Yeah, because these are parallel narratives, aren't they, in a sense?
They are, and it really is rather... astounding. Well, the cover of your book is very evocative. It really looks like London. Describe the cover of your book, Rod.
Well, it's an image of the Houses of Parliament, but it has clouds waving over the picture of Big Ben and a murky skyline, which I wanted to suggest something other than the material world, if you like. And these stories are trying to dig a little bit deeper than what you see on the surface. For example, when you go to London, which if you've been to London, you'll know that it wears its history well. You can't avoid the plaques, the monuments, which suggest that history is deep there. But how deeply do we really know that city? And that's what these stories try to explore through. As you said in the opening, some characters who are still alive and characters who have long gone but magically resurface in the stories.
Well, so many Americans travel to London. It's a favorite destination for us Americans. In fact, when I was reading your stories, it brought back a lot of memories for me of London. But I think you're right that we just see the surface.
Yes. You know, there's some very interesting juxtapositions, if you like, when you dig a little bit deeper. So, for example, the first story in the collection called The Knowledge refers to the Tate Museum, the old Tate, which is a famous art gallery where thousands of Americans and other tourists go. But actually, in the Victorian times, it was a prison. It was a prison where convicts were held before they were shipped off to Australia, to Botany Bay and other locations, for sometimes just being in debt or just, you know, a common burglary. So those are the kinds of interesting historical juxtapositions that I try to play with in some of these stories.
And the cover sets the mood for your first short story, because this American finds himself having to walk around in the rain there in London. So I would like to ask you to read the opening, this is the first story. And tell us how you have your book divided.
Well, I have the book divided into three parts. Now, part one, which six stories, which feature contemporary characters dealing with contemporary issues, you know, race relations, Brexit, the anti-Iraq war rally in 2003, so on and so forth. The second section is four stories entitled Then, and this is where I almost become a ventriloquist for characters like Charles Dickens, Virginia Woolf, Herbert Spencer. You know, I have to become their character and be them as they resurface. And then finally, I mix it up in part three, Now and Then, where I have old characters and modern characters really mixing it up on the streets of London. So before I read from the knowledge, I should say you referred to the protagonist in that story as an American. Well, actually, he's a British-born American, much like myself. His name is different.
Very much like yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
In fact, as I read that, I thought, aha, this character who in the book is named Mark is the alter ego of the author.
He's an alter ego.
Robert Burton.
Yeah, his name is Mark. I mean, he's not exactly the same as me, but he is attending a conference in London on post-colonial literature, which is my area of teaching at Chico State. And
but indeed, you are an American, but you, even though your roots are in England.
Well, I actually have two passports, one British and one American. So why don't we say I'm a hyphenated American? So anyhow, so he sits in this pub on the River Thames, on the banks of the River Thames. It's called the Morpeth Arms. And you can actually Google search Morpeth Arms, because there's a lot of historical truth in this story.
Oh, yeah. I can see that.
And he meets this mysterious figure. And so this is the opening of the story as the two encounter one another. "Do you want to know a secret?" the man asks. I look around the pub, slightly bemused by the question. "Well, do you?" he insists. He glares at me as if his life depends on an immediate answer. I put my smartphone down and smile vaguely in his direction. He moves closer to me. "There are ghosts beneath us," he says. "I mean, real ghosts, at least two of them." "Oh, really?" I say casually. I take a sip of beer and again check to see if other customers are listening. But they seem engrossed in their own private conversations. So the man continues. "Oh, yes, I know all about them, you see. They've been walking the cellars for over 100 years. Such a sad story." He swills his beer and studies the foam slide down the side of his glass, as if it's some kind of living organism. Then he drains it quickly and burps. "Fancy another pint, then?" he says, cheerily, all of a sudden. "Go on, it will do you good."
This is author Robert Burton reading from his book, London Spirits, of short stories. And in this section, this character that Mark meets in a pub, you say he drains it quickly and burps. And we don't think too much about that. We just kind of passes by. But that is a recurring motif, this character that burps. And we find out later why that was significant.
Yes. Well, I don't want to give too much away because there are some twists and surprises in the story, but I think I can give one thing away, referring to the burp, in that this mysterious stranger that Mark, i.e. me, meets in the pub could be a reincarnation of the famous British painter Joseph Turner, whose collection of works is right next door at the Tate Museum, which we talked about just a few minutes ago. And he actually suffered quite famously from dyspepsia. And one of the symptoms of dyspepsia is you are continually burping.
Well, you know, the reader, though, when we first read that, it just kind of passes by. We don't really make much of it until later, till we learn more about that. And I was wondering if you wrote this story as a way of telling about the fact this that earlier you mentioned the earlier life of the Tate was as a prison. And I was wondering if this is your way, having this character say, yeah, there are ghosts in the cellar here. If this part that you didn't actually meet a guy in a pub who told you about the ghost in the cell, or did you?
Well, I actually want to leave that up to the reader. Uh-huh. You know, it's sort of ambiguous. He could be a nutcase. And in fact, when Mark goes up to the bar to get another round of drinks, the bartender knows Puggy very well because he's a local. And you know,
Puggy, by the way, is this character Puggy, that Mark makes the acquaintance of in this pub.
That's right. And just to thicken the plot, Puggy was the nickname for Joseph Turner.
But we don't know that as the reader. We don't know that as we're reading along. We say, oh, okay, his name's Puggy.
Unless you are a great fan of Joseph Turner, in which case you might already connect the dots.
Well, you know what, though, Rob? This, your stories, and I love your short stories, they don't take long to read, maybe normally, but it took me a long time because I would say, I wonder about that. I would pull out my smartphone and ask Siri. And that's what your character is doing. So that's when you can learn things like, well, I didn't know about that German, about Joseph Turner being nicknamed Puggy.
Right.
And we don't, and I don't know that many people do, but if they are curious about some of the things you bring up in your stories, they whip out their phone and ask Siri.
Yes, I mean, there's another example. Right across the riverbank from the Morpeth Arms is MI6. Which is, you know, British intelligence. And it's famously known that at lunchtime, many of those spies, George Smiley types, come into the Morpeth Arms for their pints of beer and, you know, a plowman's lunch. And again, if you go to the website, if you go to Google or whatever website, you Morpeth Arms, you Google search that, you'll see that there's so many layers to the history of this particular establishment.
Well, another thing I Googled was Highgate Cemetery.
Yes.
East.
That's right.
And I went off on these tangents that were so fascinating.
Yeah. Shall I tell you the sort of origin of that particular story?
Yeah.
This is the one called My Insufferable Nemesis. So in 1996, that goes back a long way when actually this story started, when I got the idea for it, I was teaching a semester in London through Chico State for about 25 American students. And we did field trips, obviously as part of our curriculum. And one of the field trips we made was to Highgate East, most famous, of course, for the bust of Karl Marx. And as I was sort of walking around the bust of Karl Marx in Highgate Cemetery East, you know, and it's well decorated, people pay tribute to it, I noticed on the other side of the walkway was this rather worn down, you know, little tombstone, pretty pathetic actually. And just engraved on the side was Herbert Spencer. Herbert Spencer being, of course, one of Karl Marx's sort of intellectual opponents during the Victorian age.
And there's another case. You start that story with a quote from Herbert Spencer. I whipped out my phone and Googled Herbert Spencer.
Yeah. and so Herbert Spencer, you know, stood for individualism, kind of Darwin, private individualism and enterprise. And Marx, as we know, was all about class action and social solidarity. So I thought, well, what a strange irony that it's Marx, you know, the revolutionary whose bust is celebrated in Highgate Cemetery. And there's old Herbert Spencer, you know, who stands for individualism and private enterprise. And his tombstone is in decay. So I imagined the spirit of Herbert Spencer calling the reader, or me or you, from the top of Parliament Hill, which is close by, and gradually leading the reader to this crossroads. And Herbert Spencer sort of saying, how shocking is this, you know, that I'm the one who stands for private enterprise and there's Karl Marx winking at me across the way. How can I live in eternity with this injustice? And that's the premise of the story.
My guest is Rob Burton, and he has a collection of short stories called London Spirits. And this that you were just talking about, this cemetery, there's a local author and photographer who's traveled around to, for example, the famous Père Lachaise in Paris, and he does cemeteries that are well known. And I wouldn't be surprised if maybe this cemetery is on his list, his to-do list.
It really should be. I mean, it's an amazing place to spend a day. And you think, well, that's morbid, spending a day in a
Most
cemetery.
Most tourists don't have that on their to-do list.
They should. If you're going to London, Highgate Cemetery, it's a must-see. And as I say, it's not bleak and despondent. It's actually quite uplifting to read the lives of these celebrities as well as non-celebrities.
Well, this is in your section on then. And we kind of left Puggy hanging.
In limbo.
In limbo, because the title of that short story is The Knowledge. And did we make it clear what Puggy meant by that? Because he keeps referring to The Knowledge.
Well, I think The Knowledge has at least, you know, two meanings in this story. I mean, first and foremost, it refers to the London cab drivers who undergo a 2 to 3 year period of training whereby they have to know the streets and the landmarks of all the London area within 6 miles of Charing Cross Station downtown. That's thousands and thousands of streets. And keep in mind that London is not like an American city. It's not laid out like a grid. London is a hodgepodge of streets and alleys and cul-de-sacs.
That's more typical of older cities that just evolve.
That's right, especially European cities that have evolved in strange, crazy ways. And it's quite famous that the London cab drivers, as they go through this 2 to 3 year period of initiation, it's been proven actually through MRI scans that their brains expand, the hippocampus part of their brain, which is responsible for a memory, expands because of this knowledge that they are acquiring. And so it sort of makes me examine in the story, what do we mean by knowledge? And I have, as you know, as you alluded to earlier, I have this kind of knowledge juxtaposed with the knowledge that Siri gives us.
On our phones.
You know, where you just click your phone and it gives you instant information. But the question that the story, I hope, poses is, you know, is that really knowledge? Or is that just sort of superfice?
Well, now, is this just in your story that this knowledge that cab drivers must have is just here? Or did you meet a character who says, boy, these cab drivers have to have the knowledge? Is the knowledge, is that what people mean in London?
Oh, yes.
So
yes.
That's commonly used.
Oh, it is, definitely. The knowledge, with a capital K. In fact, there's a BBC series called The Knowledge. And it's a comedy program because it's about these cab drivers, you know, who have to undertake this 2 to 3 year endurance test. And then they are tested for it afterwards and with crazy questions like, all right, then, mate, how do you get from Victoria Coach Station to Trafalgar Square via the embankment? Give it to me, you know, and then you've got to, you know, you've got to give the answer. And if you fail, you know, two or three of those answers, you fail the knowledge.
And then you have your character, your British-American character, introduce Puggy to the knowledge. This other meaning of knowledge.
Oh, that's right, which is technology.
Because he wasn't familiar with Siri. Cindy?
That's right, Cindy, yeah. So, again, it's just trying to play with this concept or this theme of what we mean by knowledge. Do digital tools give us the same amount of knowledge, let's say, as non-digital tools? Yeah. And I have to say, just as a footnote, that actually in the story, there's a reference to the cabbie strike against Uber. And that's actually a real event. London has banned Uber taxis precisely because it wants to protect the old-fashioned way of driving cabs through the knowledge, not through digital technology.
Yeah, and I did know that was a true part because sometimes was this Rob's imagination or is this a fact? Now, we were talking about this cemetery where Karl Marx's people visit his grave, and here's poor Herbert Spencer being kind of ignored. So would you read the opening paragraphs of My Insufferable Nemesis? And your narrators, so when I'm reading your stories, it's kind of a mystery and suspense. Okay, who's the narrator here, and what's going to happen here?
Yeah.
So when I read the title, My Insufferable Nemesis, I don't know who the me is, first person is, but I get a clue by your quote.
Yes, there's a little epigraph right underneath the title, and the epigraph goes as follows, and it's a quote by Herbert Spencer. We have unmistakable proof that throughout all past times, there has been a ceaseless devouring of the weak by the strong. And that's a quote that typifies Herbert Spencer, you know, because he was this arch Darwinist. Only the strong will survive. How ironic it is that it's his tombstone which has fallen to pieces, whereas Marx's is, you know, it's renovated every 6 months. It has flowers and garlands, and there are hundreds of tourists flocked around, and people are ignoring him. So this is the setup for the story. I'll read the first two paragraphs. If you happen to find yourself on top of Parliament Hill, be sure to stop and admire the view of London's famous landmarks laid out before you. On a clear day, you might see as far as Canary Wharf, or possibly the Houses of Parliament, shimmering in the distance. As you stand there taking in the sights, you'll no doubt feel a powerful breeze tug at your overcoat and hear the rustling of leaves from a cluster of oak trees halfway down the hill. You'll turn to look, and your attention will be drawn to a prominent green dome on the opposite side of the hill. Adjacent to this dome, out of view, is Highgate Cemetery East. Here, in plot 54, is where my remains are to be found. I see that I have commanded your attention. Perhaps, therefore, you will allow me to guide you towards my resting place and share the story of my insufferable nemesis along the way.
This is Rob Burton reading from his short story in his collection, London Spirits, and that was My Insufferable Nemesis. And this was from his section of the book, Then. It's divided into Now, Current, and Then, some past historical figure, and then you combine the two in the third part. For example, your characters, you have them speaking you have their dialogue written down, and I can just hear this.
Yeah.
I can hear their accents. I can hear their intonation when I'm reading the dialogue.
Yeah, you know, and the easiest story from the middle section, where I try to get inside the head, try to get inside the voice of these past characters, was the Sherlock Holmes story.
Yes.
Where, you know, I because if you read many Sherlock Holmes stories, the pacing of the language and the archaic sentence structures, they're really fun to adopt. And so becoming Dr. Watson in this story, The Curious Case of Miss Irene Adler, actually was probably the easiest story to write. I had to do a lot of shaping and revising, obviously, to make sure I got it exactly right. Because one word that's wrong and you lose the voice. You know, people are going to say, well, that's not Dr. Watson. That sounds like Rob Burton. But I actually enjoyed that story, I think, most of all.
I've been a fan of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle since I was young. I was rather young when I started reading his stories. So I was delighted to see that you included this story, The Curious Case of Miss Irene Adler.
Yes.
And I Googled Irene Adler.
That's right. and do you know, what did it say about her?
Well, it said she was an opera singer.
Yep.
She was American.
Yep.
And it also... I don't want to spoil too much of it.
Well, she was, in terms of the canon of Conan Doyle stories, Sherlock, she was the only woman who kind of second-guessed him and won.
And
you
that was in there, too. And bested him.
That's right, bested him. That's the perfect word. And so here in this story, she brings him out of retirement. You know, he's become a beekeeper now. You know, he's had his opium addiction, that's solved. He's finished Baker Street. He's in his Sussex countryside. He's beekeeping. But there's still that nagging sense that it was Miss Irene Adler who bested him.
And yet she's not a recurring character. She was only in one of his stories.
Right, only in one of his stories. And isn't it strange that Conan Doyle just kind of dropped her, you know, and never comes back to her?
Holmes does not forget her.
That's right. Well, in my story, it's still deep down inside his subconsciousness. And he goes on, or she goes on in this story, to best him a second time. And the way the story is resolved is that finally Holmes is okay with that. He realizes that he's met his match. And it's a woman.
That outwitted him.
That outwitted him. And of course, Watson says, "Good God, man, have you lost your senses? You've lost out to a woman." But Holmes says, "You know what? I'm going back to beekeeping. It's been a long week. I'm going back to beekeeping. I've been beaten, finally."
Well, and then there's a surprise in this story, too. I won't reveal what the surprise is, but we're reading along. Oh, that's too bad. And then we realize, oh, no, that's okay.
Yeah. I'm not quite sure what that surprise is, but...
Well, that Holmes reads Irene Adler's obituary.
Oh, that's right. That's right. And again, she invented that ruse to bring him out of his retirement so that she could, win the second battle.
This is a collection of short stories called London Spirits. They're short stories by Rob Burton, who's a professor at Chico State University and is British-American, hyphenated. And there is a short story in your book entitled London Spirits. And we get a clue on the inside page is a motif that is fairly recent. I mean, London has such a long history, but this is new on the horizon.
That's right.
And when we come back, I want to ask you about the significance of this motif that's on the inside of your book. And you don't tell us about this until the very last short story in your book that's called London Spirits. So I want to ask you about that. We're going to take a break. I want to ask you about that and also about a plumber story that you include in your book. My guest is Rob Burton. His collection of short stories is London Spirits. And after our break, after I talk to Rob a little bit more about his book, Paradise author Stephen Arrington will tell us how he became a co-defendant in a cocaine conspiracy trial with car designer John DeLorean and how he finally received a presidential pardon. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. And Professor Burton has collected some short stories called London Spirits, and I wanted to ask him about the title of this book and how this new landmark on the London scene and the significance of that, because this story starts out high atop the London Eye.
That's right, and the London Eye was built in 1999. That was actually due to open on New Year's Eve to celebrate the new millennium, so sort of December 31st, 1999. It was supposed to have its inaugural turn, but due to a mechanical failure, it didn't turn. So it was another one of those great British cock-ups, as they say. The story takes place on the eve of the millennium.
In fact, I wondered if, because I don't know the reason for that, and so I wondered the reason you give in your story, you came up with that, I suppose.
Oh, I came up with that,
As to why that it didn't make its inaugural turn when it was expected to.
That's right. I sort of do a lot of imagining as to why it didn't turn. There is, as you know, on top of the eye on this auspicious moment.
Which is it? Did we say it's a Ferris wheel?
A Ferris wheel, yeah. That's right. The London
huge.
Eye is a huge Ferris wheel right on the south bank of the River Thames opposite the Houses of Parliament. Very popular with tourists and definitely worth going on if you are planning a visit.
So you've been on the Ferris wheel?
Oh, yes. Yeah, it was a rainy day, so I actually couldn't see too much from the top. But on a gloriously bright day, you do get a fantastic view of London's landmarks. So I imagined Boadicea, Queen Boadicea, who fought back against the Romans, sitting on top of this wheel, this Ferris wheel.
So this is how you call this section Then and Now, because you take a character from ancient history.
That's right.
And put her in the 21st century.
That's right. In the 21st century, as the Londoners are going about their celebrations, this is a story that mixes the material world and the spiritual world. So you've got boozy celebrants, you know, on the streets of London enjoying their drinks, their spirits. But you've also got spirits themselves who are enjoying their celebration, including Boadicea, who commands this game, the Great Games, as I call it, whereby a riddle is posed and the players have to answer the riddle. And the riddle is, what sport are we most famous for in this country of ours, this Britannia? And of course, no one gets it right until this coal miner's daughter at the end says, well, actually, I don't think we have a sport that we're famous for. I think we're, quote unquote, right crap at everything. But we do know how to master the art of fair play. And that's a sort of an expression that Brits love to use, you know, well, fair play. You know, this idea of it's all a level playing field, and honor and dignity and integrity can be upheld on the rugby pitch, so on and so forth. And that's the answer. That's the answer that wins her the top prize, which is to take a seat next to Boadicea on top of the wheel as it rotates in the spirit world. But of course, in the material world, we know it didn't rotate because there was a mechanical failure that day.
Now, I mentioned I was going to ask you, you have a story about a plumber, of all people, and I've assumed that what you have in the very beginning of this short story about the plumber is an actual plaque.
Yes.
That exists. And this plumber's name is Philip Clark.
That's right.
And he's the narrator of Spirit Helpers.
That's right.
And interesting, you just used a word when you were talking about this last story, London Spirits, a little four-letter word that comes up
as
a character almost in the story about the plumber. So tell us who this Philip Clark character is.
Well, first of all, the four-letter word that I was referring to, of course, goes back to the name Thomas Crapper, and he is a historical figure, you know, a Victorian plumber, quite famous for various inventions.
But I think we kind of have the wrong idea about exactly what he invented, because the flush toilet was already in existence long before Thomas Crapper came along.
That's right. But he modified it for sort of London hygiene purposes. Philip Clark, is actually buried out in the West Cloisters of Westminster Abbey. And again, it was one of those field trips I took with my students. You go to Westminster Abbey, you know, to see the burial sites of Geoffrey Chaucer and Charles Dickens and other celebrities. And then as I was walking outside of the main part of Westminster Abbey in one of the cloisters, I couldn't help but notice this plaque, which simply said, Philip Clark, plumber to this collegiate church, born the 22nd of October, 1664, died 21st of September, 1707. And that's all it said. It's very simple, modest. And I began to imagine, what if he had done some pretty important things during his life? You know, so for example, during the coronation of William of Orange and Mary in 1689, what if he actually helped to flush out, if you like, some of the problems, some of the hygienic problems that may have taken place in that particular event. So this then becomes a story about how a modest plumber actually gets elected to the highest post-life sort of pedestal.
You use this expression to flush out.
Yeah.
And also in this story, he says, I'm capable of plumbing the deepest secrets of the universe.
That's right.
You know, you couldn't resist these puns. But you know what I enjoyed about this character, too, is that his alliteration. besides the puns on flushing and plumbing, you have him say, he's this, you mentioned Thomas Crapper. In truth, Thomas swallowed his zeal for the afterlife. In plain English, he spent his spunk, murdered his mirth, and cobbled his cobble.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm sure you can appreciate that because we were talking before the show started that you played Cockney roles in your theatrical career. And this character, Philip Clark, I imagine him as a kind of a chummy Cockney, you know what I mean? And he talks like this. And Cockneys do use this kind of rhyming slang quite a bit. So I'll go back to that same sentence and I'll read it out as if he were Cockney.
Oh, please do.
In truth, Thomas swallowed his zeal for the afterlife. In plain English, he spent his spunk, murdered his mirth, and cobbled his carble. Now, of course, no one could understand what I said, so I'm glad you read it more appropriately. But that's how a Cockney would have said it.
Well, I was amused that you have a plumber being humorous. I enjoyed his sense of humor that you gave him.
Yeah. And not only did I give him a sense of humor, but I gave him the top job, as it were. And there's another character, a historical character in this story, Christopher Wren, who, of course, is on a pedestal, and we know him historically as the man who sort of rescued London architecturally after the Great Fire of 1666. But I reverse the order here. It's Philip Clark who's top of the pedestal, you know, whispering into God or goddess's ear, and it's Christopher Wren.
But he calls the god, he has a name for God.
Yeah.
Governor.
The governor. That's right.
The governor. Yeah. And so you read that and you realize, oh, he means God.
Well,
he says the governor.
And I try to make it a-religious in a sense. So
you could
put your own god or goddess in there. But yeah, it's just to Philip Clark, it's the governor. It's my boss. And it's Christopher Wren who's struggling to get to that position, you know. So he may have had material success, but the question the story poses is, well, what about in the afterlife?
Well, and you often give your characters a middle name that is very British. Americans don't understand this as a derogatory term, but like Christopher Bloody Wren.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Or Bleeding. And your characters often insert that little commentary in between a character's first and last name.
Yeah, and that's a very typical sort of Cockney expression, is as you said, you add the expletive in the middle.
Well, you have these two characters who one has been a plumber, and you have his plaque, so he was a real person. And we know that Thomas Crapper was an actual person who they were not contemporaries, though.
No, that's right. Thomas Crapper was a Victorian plumber, and Philip Clark, as we said, was sort of late 17th century. So the way the story is framed is that Philip Clark is trying to help Thomas Crapper be elevated to the heavenly elect. And he's a little bit down in the dumps.
Because the name of the short story is Spirit Helpers.
Yeah.
It doesn't have anything about plumbing in the title. So why is it entitled Spirit Helpers?
Because ultimately, that's what Philip Clark helps Thomas Crapper to do. He becomes a spirit helper. So the story ends with the two floating across Westminster Bridge, and they help a homeless person kind of cross the bridge. Now, the homeless person just feels this sense of elevation. Obviously, it's not a material touch, but you know how it is sometimes. If you do believe in the spirit world, there's that shiver that goes down your spine, or you kind of look around as if, is there someone behind me? And so that's the suggestion at the end. So Thomas Crapper actually passes his ritual test at the end by helping this homeless person by becoming a spirit helper.
My guest is Rob Burton, and his collection of short stories is London Spirits, and he has divided the book into Then, Now, and Now and Then. And so the story of the plumbers, or I guess Thomas Crapper was not exactly a plumber. He had a business that and he didn't invent the flush toilet.
That's right.
As most people think. Rob, it's been such a pleasure talking to you about your collection of short stories. I thoroughly enjoyed them. And I will look forward to your next book.
Thanks very much, Nancy. It was an absolute delight.
My guest has been Rob Burton, his collection of short stories, London Spirits. When Stephen Arrington wrote his first memoir, Extreme, he couldn't tell the whole story of being a co-defendant in a cocaine conspiracy trial with car designer John DeLorean. When Steve became the sole survivor of the drug trial of the century, he could write the rest of the story. Steve was convicted, but on President Obama's last day in office, he granted Stephen Arrington a presidential pardon. Steve Arrington, welcome.
Pleasure to be here, Nancy.
Why did it take so long?
Because my case was called the drug trial of the century. And there were some emails that were leaked, and President Obama requested that no high-profile drug dealer came across his desk. And so he waited until 2 days left in his administration. And when they called, I was absolutely stunned, and I cried. And I thought, as a macho guy, I just bawled. My wife, Cindy, just hugged me because I waited 9 years for that pardon. And Nancy, what's important is because of marijuana, I fell from the rank of heroes. Now, when I say that, I'm not being self-serving. I was a bomb disposal frogman. The longest walk in the world is walking in on an unexploded bomb. I have done that. And that's it was important to me. And so I fell from that. And then I got caught up in that in the DeLorean case. And that was under threat of a gun. But the bottom line is I did it. And I deserved my incarceration. I did 31 and a half months, and I deserved every day of it.
So President Obama could not pardon some high-profile drug dealer. And you can't get much higher profile than having your picture on the front page of the L.A. Times with John DeLorean.
It was amazing to be what they call a celebrity inmate. It was on the news all the time. It was bigger than the O.J. Simpson trial. It was huge. And I knew that under the spotlight that I was probably getting a very serious sentence because I refused to cooperate. And the only reason I refused to cooperate is I didn't need to hurt anybody else. I had a time to serve of incarceration, and I was prepared to do that.
And they wanted you to rat out the others.
Well, you know what? They didn't really need me. That's the part. You see, the man I worked for, Morgan Hetrick, who I thought was a legitimate businessman, and he was a cocaine transporter. I didn't know he was a coke guy until it was too late when the guns came out. And I was ordered to co-pilot a plane to Colombia and drive a car from Florida to California. I didn't want to do either of those things, but I did them. And so why should I put it off on somebody else? I deserved to be punished. And there was nothing I could tell the government didn't already know. But the reason why they wanted me so bad is I was going to go to trial first. John DeLorean and I, we merged our defenses, and I'm going to go before the judge first, and they're going to have a chance to hear everything that the prosecution witnesses have to say before DeLorean goes up. So they thought if they could get me to cooperate, then they might be able to get John DeLorean to plead guilty.
And was he guilty?
He wasn't not guilty of a drug crime. That is the most important aspect here. People ask me, was he guilty? Well, I don't know what he was like as a businessman, but I do know what happened in this case. And not only do I know what happened in this case, John DeLorean and I, we merged our defenses. And so I have all the files. Now, when I say I have the files, there was the press was really after the transcripts of the secret tapes. I have those. I have the court exhibits by the FBI. I have the FBI investigative reports. I have John DeLorean's investigative reports. I have all the evidence. And it shows 100% that John DeLorean was set up by the government, that the government broke the chain of evidence by destroying evidence, that they lied, and that they threatened him. And I don't want to get too far ahead of myself, but laws were broken by government agents, including breaking into houses and getting caught. Now, when you're a federal agent and the police come and everything else and he shows his badge and his name's Gerald Scotti and he's the number lead investigator in the John DeLorean case, that's not a good thing. So this case, it goes much higher than people know. You want to know where it begins, Nancy?
Yes, I do. Let me remind people that I'm talking to Stephen Arrington, and the title of his autobiography was Extreme. And he told what he was able to tell at that time in his first book. He told the story of what he was able to tell at the time. Now, Steve, you're telling us things that you could not say in that first book. Is that right?
Well, the first book, I was telling my autobiography. And this is different People have been asking me, you know the conspiracy, you know everything, tell the story. And what worried me is if I told the whole story, that might influence whether I got a presidential pardon or not. But I decided it needed to be told. And so the John DeLorean drug trial begins with Margaret Thatcher, the Iron Lady of England. And the reason why is in Ireland, they were having big problems. The Republican Army was blowing people up, shooting people. It was a war, and they needed jobs. And John DeLorean started an automobile company there from when they first started. It took 2 years to drive the first car off the line. That's amazing. The government of England helped, about £138 million to get the company going, and other money came in. And then £18 million went missing. And there was three individuals who had some involvement, and one of them was John DeLorean. And one man went to prison. One man had a heart attack and died, and John DeLorean was living in the United States and was not going back over to England, and Margaret Thatcher couldn't get him. And Margaret Thatcher had another problem. It was called the Falkland War. 127 ships, 26,000 soldiers. She could have lost that war, and Ronnie Reagan, she thought would help her, but she didn't get the help she wanted. And that was a scar on their relationship. And they had a meeting before the John DeLorean drug trial got started. We don't know what was said behind those in that room, but Edwin Meese directed all these government agencies to go after John DeLorean. But the problem is the government had nothing. They're trying to get him. They can't get him. And there was a con man by the name of James Timothy Hoffman who had smuggled cocaine and marijuana up from Central America to the California. He got caught. He became government witness. And he's still a con man. And he wants to get paid. He wants to make money. So he's trying to develop cases. And he sees that they are after John DeLorean. And he says, well, John DeLorean was my neighbor. Well, that's not exactly true. They lived in the same town. And he says, I know him. Well, he met him once because his son, Hoffman's son and DeLorean's son, went dirt biking for an afternoon. And that was it. And so he says, I can deliver. He says to Gerald Scotty, he says, I can deliver John DeLorean. So he went after John DeLorean. And they had a meeting. He called John DeLorean up and he says, look, I see in the Wall Street Journal that you need money. He says, I have access to big time money. I can get you $60 million. And so John DeLorean, he needs $60 million to save his company. So he agrees to meet with him. And supposedly this meeting was not recorded, but this was specifically set up to record that, you know, to get John DeLorean on tape. And when he said, I'll get you $60 million, he says to John DeLorean, but I want a finder's fee. If I get you $60 million, I want $1.8 million. Then he goes back to his FBI handlers and he says, John DeLorean wants to invest $1.8 million to get $50 to $60 million back selling heroin from Indonesia.
Which was a total lie.
Which was a total lie. But you see, James Hoffman, the con man, is the one who ran this case. Because he's telling one thing to the FBI, another thing to to John DeLorean. And he builds this whole case. And then he tells John DeLorean, well, the money's coming from people in Colombia. And John DeLorean goes, uh-oh, I'm not sure I want to be a part of this. And then Hoffman reveals, well, they're actually cocaine smugglers, and they have all this money, and they need to invest it. And John DeLorean says, I want out. I don't want anything to do with this. And Hoffman says, you know too much. They'll kill your kids. And that scared John DeLorean to death. And he didn't know how to get out. And you see, I really understood what he had to deal with because—
You were in a similar situation.
Exactly.
You couldn't get out.
Nancy, to be 100% honest on this, I thought I was a macho guy. I was a bomb disposal frogman. I worked with frog teams. And when I was with the teams, it was no man left behind. You had courage because you had purpose and you had people standing behind you. When I got caught up with the Medellin drug cartel, those scary people— I didn't know how to get out. They're going to kill me. They've told me they're going to kill me. They'll kill my family. If you upset them, they'll come in your house. They'll kill everybody in your house. If you have a goldfish, they'll kill it. They'll kill your dog, make you watch all of it. And then they'll torture and kill you.
And that's what John DeLorean was up against.
And that's what John DeLorean was up
against. And you understood being in that situation, being in his shoes.
Exactly. And so they threatened him. And he also got threatened by a DEA agent. Remember, I have the files. I have the evidence. He got threatened, and he didn't know how to get out. He's trying to get out. He couldn't get out. And so now he's having to go along with it, And a long story short, because we could do hours on this, is that when DeLorean was supposed to put up $1.8 million, he said, "I don't have it." He said the Irish Republican Army was putting up the $1.8 million, and they don't have it. And I had to give the $1.8 million I had to the receiver, and the money's gone. And so they said, "You mean the deal's dead?" And he says, "Yeah, the deal's dead." And the agent was mad. And he says, "Well, what are we going to do?" And he says, "Well, unless you have some other ideas." Well, they had some other ideas. They wanted him to put 40 DeLoreans up as collateral. For $1.8 million, 40 DeLoreans, math doesn't work. But they wanted some collateral.
Automobiles now, you might add.
Yeah.
When you say DeLoreans.
Yeah, yeah, DeLoreans. So
his
car. Back to the Future car.
Yes.
And so what he did is he made a shell company. DeLorean Motor Company is what was building the DeLorean Motor Car. DeLorean Motor Car Company was an empty shell that he made up, and it was worth nothing. Now, everybody knows it's worth nothing, but he tells them that he's going to give them half of DeLorean Motor Car Company, and they're going to give him $50 to $60 million for that. And when the jury heard that, they're just going, "No way are we going to buy this. This doesn't work." And the agent actually admitted before Wiseman, the lead attorney, that that was the actual plan. And it's foolish. You don't turn $2 million, $1.8 million worth of cocaine into $50 or $60 million in 1 week. It's impossible.
My guest is Stephen Arrington, and his autobiography was entitled Extreme, and he told his own story in that book. He has a second book entitled In DeLorean's Shadow, The Drug Trial of the Century by the Sole Surviving Defendant. So since you're the only one that can really tell this story, you came out with another book and telling more of what you could not tell in your previous book.
And more of what I was afraid to tell, because I really wanted a presidential pardon. And they were trying so hard to get me to cooperate. The man I worked for, Morgan Hetrick, he cooperated. He agreed to turn evidence and everything. And they couldn't get me to cooperate. And so they sent in a federal agent to scare me. And he did. He did a great job of scaring me, but I still didn't cooperate. So they sent Morgan Hetrick into my cell block for a week after he's already given all of his evidence. And he's trying to get me to cooperate, and I won't. And he told me, he said, "Steve," he said, "I really feel sorry about what I've done to you. So I'm going to tell you the things that you need, everything I can to help you with your defense." And I said to him, I said, "You know, Morgan, I was working at a surf shop and I was happy. I was going broke, but I was happy. And you came in and you ruined my life and you offered me this incredible job. You're going to pay me $50,000 a year 35 years ago. You're going to pay me $50,000 a year. You said you're going to double it every 6 months. And I was going to become an executive vice president of your company. So you're going to turn your business over to me." I said, why'd you have to tell me that? He said, "Steve, I was going to turn my business over to you." I said, "Are you talking about the cocaine business?" He said, "What other type of business was I in?" I go, "What do you mean you're going to turn it over to me?" He said, "Steve, you're a Navy frog." He says, you know all these guys who
Plus you're a pilot.
I'm a pilot, but I know all these guys who are commandos. He says, "The thing about the cartels, they're employing Colombians who didn't graduate from middle school, and they're all emotions, and they do stupid things." He says, "We can get all this high-tech equipment. We could have run this big operation." And I'm going, I never would have brought my people in. And you know what, Nancy? I'm a lousy criminal. I want to be a good guy, not a bad guy. But Pablo Escobar was going to put up a couple million dollars. They wanted to get airplanes and build a network around me. I didn't know any of this. And so if I revealed that, my chances of my pardon, you know, are going out the door. I decided to reveal it about a year ago. I wrote the whole story. If I didn't get my pardon, then I didn't get my pardon. I wanted to tell the story of what happened between DeLorean, Hetrick, and I, and these agents who lied in court, who falsified evidence, who broke the law in their attempt to get an innocent man. And when I say an innocent man, John DeLorean was innocent of any drug dealing whatsoever. I prove it in the book. You read the book, it's there. And I have all the files. And I'm doing a lot of bigot time interviews, and people are seeing these files right now. I'll give you an idea. On Exhibit B, Item 15, it says that they interviewed John DeLorean early in the month of July. But they didn't record it because it was a social event. Well, the social event was their snitch bringing John DeLorean into a bar to try to get him involved in a drug deal. That's not a social event. And then the next meeting was the 15th of July. And at that meeting, John DeLorean is being introduced to a supposedly dirty banker who's really an undercover FBI agent. And they said they didn't record that one because John DeLorean was not yet a target by the DEA. Well, I have a transcript of a tape from July the 2nd where they're in DeLorean is talking to that same banker. And so they provided as evidence to the court false information when evidence was there to prove it, and Wiseman found it, and he went after it.
Now explain who Wiseman is.
Wiseman was the lead attorney. He and Ray were the attorneys for John DeLorean, defense attorneys.
And this, what you're telling us now, you recount in your more recent book, In DeLorean's Shadow, The Drug Trial of the Century by the Sole Surviving Defendant. So you knew what really went on. And it is kind of amazing that you were so strong when you were up against all these powerful people. Because when you were younger, you made some bad choices, Steve. I hate to say it, but you did.
Well, I grew up in a broken family. I didn't have a father teach me about my moral compass and everything. I thought the whole world was all about Steve Arrington. And so that's the way I lived my life, as a bomb disposal frogman and everything.
Because that's a very elite group. They don't just let anybody who wants to be a frogman be one. It's very selective.
Well, in our bomb disposal class, about 1,000 people seriously applied. 32 of us were accepted, and 6 of us graduated. And it was $1 million education back in 35 years ago. And so it was a big deal. And that's what I forfeited because of marijuana. And that's what led to this whole thing with the DeLorean case.
Because you had a very nice career in the Navy, 14 years
14,
in the Navy.
14 years working with the Secret Service, protecting foreign heads of state, top secret military operations, recovery of reentry vehicles from space, phenomenal diving. It was all adventure, and I threw it away because of marijuana was illegal. Okay? Now, it's changing now, but 2 ounces of marijuana is what ruined my career. But I'm the one who did it. I always want people to know, I did it. No excuse.
For more information about Steve's story, including links to national and local news reports, head to our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'd also like to thank my first guest, Chico State Professor Rob Burton, and he wrote a collection of short stories called London Spirits. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.